This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. It's our weekly review of local news, and joining us this week for an update on the heroin crisis in our region, our Cincinnati Inquirer heroin and social issues reporter, Terry DeMeo, and WCPO.com issues reporter, Lisa Bernard-Kuhn. Later in the show, we'll talk about the presidential race on the ground in Ohio and the Donald Trump rally last night at U.S. Bank Arena with WCPO.com government and political reporter Amanda Seitz and Inquirer local politics reporter Jeremy Fugelberg. You can join our conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Terry and Lisa, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Good afternoon. Yeah.
There was a huge surge of heroin overdoses in the summer that was connected with some extremely potent drugs such as fentanyl and carfentanil being mixed in with the heroin. What level of this are we experiencing at this point, Lisa? Have things calmed down? Are they still about the same as they were in the summer?
I'll let Cherry chime in as well. What I'm hearing is they're still monitoring it as though it could take off at any moment. I mean, the memory of what just happened in August and September is still very top of mind for many of the first responders. I think we have seen the overdoses tick down just a bit, but knowing that this fentanyl and carfentanil could still be out there, and we've seen it, you know, pick up in other cities surrounding us, in other states surrounding us in West Virginia. So there's just this standby, if you will, that it could be coming back at any time.
Yeah, I'm hearing the same thing, Lisa, and checking things out the same way. I did meet with Chief Sinan yesterday, who is, of course, is the director of the Hamilton County Heroin Task Force. And he said that while the overdoses have gone down, they're still experiencing something like 20 to 25 in a day, which might have been a week's worth a few months back. So he said, you know, they talk about at what point is this a crisis, a hit the alarms crisis. They're wondering if it's a new normal, in his words.
But Terry, as far as the response from local officials to that surge in the summer and then what's continued to go on since then, how do you think they've done in responding to this?
I think there's been an obvious effort to figure out what to do to make sure that first responders all have enough naloxone. I know that was an issue, and that was an issue at one of our local hospitals as well, to make sure that they have enough. I know of a couple of Northern Kentucky police departments who are now trained or just beginning to be trained in giving naloxone. And there's this discussion of more what the Hamilton County Heroin Coalition has called QRTs, quick response teams, and these are the folks that go out within a week of somebody's overdose, had that person been hospitalized, and try to talk to them about getting into treatment. I still think that we are far from safe from repeat overdoses, and that there needs to be a response right at the hospital levels, and that people who are using active users, using heroin or other IV drugs, need to be armed with naloxone because, of course, they are actually there with their friends or with others, if anyone is, when they overdose.
Yeah, the need for more naloxone, again, is one of those issues that's really top of mind for the officials that are working hardest on this. So we've seen Hamilton County make the move from typically having in stock, you know, a dose of naloxone that's, I think, 2 milligrams. They've upped that to having, you know, handing out to all of their first responders this higher 4 milligram dosage.
And they've had to do that because the heroin's more potent because of the mixtures?
This carfentanil that has been added is, you know, thousands times more powerful than heroin. And so that's exactly what they're doing. So again, just making sure that they have the naloxone on hand, trying to figure out, you know, where they need to be and when they need to be there.
Lisa, go ahead, Terry.
No, absolutely. I agree with her. They're just making sure that they've got it and trying to figure out new steps to take.
Lisa, the city has started a database to keep track of this. How is that going to help in fighting this? What's the idea behind that?
So as overdoses were spiking, the city's Office of Performance and Data Analytics began calling through all the data that they have at their disposal to figure out, you know, what can we put together here that's going to give us any leg up, so to speak, on understanding where in our city are the biggest problems with overdoses. How should we deploy resources based on that kind of information? So they're using things, public records that are available as a result of emergency medical runs, and they're pinpointing where the most overdoses are occurring in the city. And so we know the west side of the city is where we've really seen the spikes. And I'm just trying to pull up some data here. I think it's West Price Hill. You know, you've seen over 100 overdoses in that two-week about a month period between the end of August and September when we saw the carfentanil being introduced. And so they're using that kind of data, again, just to figure out where they need to put their resources.
Again, 513-419-7100. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can also email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Terry, you've been doing a series for the Inquirer this week that takes a look at how Baltimore has been responding to the heroin crisis. So I'm wondering what attracted your attention to Baltimore? Why that city?
Well, I had been hearing about Baltimore as I've expanded my coverage to get a better idea of what was going on here and what should be done. Of course, I looked outside of our region and nationally. But then in the spring, I was at an American Society of Addiction Medicine conference, and I specifically was seeking a place that we could explore that is known among the addiction experts and being watched by the addiction experts that may be doing some things that are innovative or just, you know, doing a bunch of things, and the name Baltimore kept coming up. So that's where Carrie Cochran and I went to look at what they do in July.
Tell us about how Baltimore has approached this. What makes their approach unique?
Well, I would say that every response that they have, every initiative that they have taken is based on addiction science. And I think we're getting there now. But Baltimore, sadly, had an early experience with a large population of IV drug users. That is why when they were experiencing HIV problems significant problems in the 90s, they threw resources at needle exchange. And as we all know here, needle exchange is minimal, and it's hard to be accepted by, we just don't have the political climate in some cases or the residents' understanding or interest in pursuing this kind of a harm reduction thing. So they're ahead in that way, for example. Another thing is medication-assisted treatment. It is the rule in Baltimore because abstinence has so much less success with people, particularly with opioid and heroin addiction. So the idea for a drug court to provide methadone, Suboxone, or Vivitrol, which is a non-narcotic and is attractive here and is used here to some extent now, the idea there is, well, of course we'll do that. And they also have, we have some really good knowledge now, as Lisa's fully aware of, and I believe reported on, of where the overdoses are coming from, how many people are involved, what the demographics are. But in Baltimore, there is a team of people that includes public defenders, judges, jailers, public health people, social services, and many more, that every month takes a look at every overdose fatality to try to find the holes. Did this happen after so-and-so is released from jail? Did they have naloxone? Where in the system did this person drop treatment? You know, all of these kind of questions are asked and reviewed so that they can kind of jump in and try to save people and make systems changes to help reduce the dying.
And Terry, they're giving training in Baltimore, right, on how to use naloxone and Narcan, right?
Yes. We provide a lot of training. We have our health departments involved and our hospital in Northern Kentucky involved in providing first responders with naloxone and sometimes the training, depending on where you're looking. We have a lot of public, a lot of grassroots groups that are private that are bringing naloxone out and about. But one thing that really jumped out at me was the very specific attention to getting naloxone into the hands of their IV drug-using population for the very same reason that we discussed before. You know, who's the most likely to save someone with naloxone? Someone who is with that person. That doesn't negate any of the efforts that are both going on here and in Baltimore to get naloxone into the hands of as many residents and family members as possible.
The other thing that Baltimore has done that I saw in your article was they have one person who acts as the authority over all this. They have a doctor who is experienced with the heroin epidemic, overseeing things. How much is having that one person who makes the decisions on this issue, how much has that helped the city?
It has helped gain attention and speak to residents. They do have heroin coalitions. They do have a city one, a state Maryland heroin coalition that involves, you know, some of the heads that you will see. But she is able to talk to the medical community, and she is a face and a voice for not only Baltimore, but for, you know, the nation about how to approach this, and she is advised and gets information from people who are in the medical sector of addiction treatment. So I think it's just an identifier for people, and someone who has to be very aggressive about this, someone who is very public and frankly just goes at it full out and is supported by her communities.
We will continue our conversation. You can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining me this afternoon with an update on the heroin crisis and efforts to fight it, Cincinnati Inquirer heroin and social issues reporter Terry DeMeo and WCPO.com issues reporter Lisa Bernard-Kuhn. You can join us at 513-419-7100. Email talk at WVXU.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. So, Terry, as far as Baltimore is concerned, how successful, how much of a reduction in this problem have they seen because of the approach they're taking?
Well, in the first quarter of 2016, which was a year after Dr. Nguyen headed up this fight of hers, you know, became kind of the anti-heroin czar, I would call her, I guess. They saw their overdoses drop by 24%, which was, for them, gigantic. Now, I have to tell you that since then, you know, I've checked back, and they've had an increase in overdoses again, and it's climbing, and they have identified that as largely fentanyl. They have not experienced the carfentanil that we have to this point, or at least till a few days ago. And so what they did was, okay, create a team to respond to fentanyl and then move people out, public health people, out to places where there are known active heroin users or IV drug users and warn them as surges come up. You know, so they're watching and using that as an additional thing to try to quell some of the overdoses.
513-419-7100 to join us. And let's talk with Larry in Northside. Hi, Larry.
Hey, Mark. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
I'm listening to the conversation. Real quick, I'm a musician, and I've lived in downtown Cincinnati area for a long, long time. Was addicted to heroin for 21 years, and I'm clean now. Just got off methadone, and basically, it blows my mind that this city, after all these years, it also blows my mind that this has become epidemic now, because when I started using the drug, it was so underground, it was so divergent, it was, you were part of the dregs, or you were down on your luck, or you were part of the counterculture, and, you know, those were the only people that used it, and now it's to see that it's mainstream in some way, and yet, after all these years, the penal system is still the only real recompense that society in this area still is resorting to. It's appalling to me that we are not investing in our kids, we're not investing in our youth, and we're criminalizing an illness. And we're not learning from it, because it ruined my life. I ended up spending 4 years in prison instead of getting put into drug treatment. Had never been put in rehab one time. The judge put his hammer down and put me in prison for 4 years. Destroyed my life.
Larry, I'm glad things are going better for you now, though.
It's hard. It's really hard. All I have to say to anybody out there that's listening is, don't give up. You can do it. Fight. Don't give up. Just keep fighting.
Stories like yours are just so incredibly important and powerful. You know, I think about this epidemic, and I think of all the time we spend talking about the drug, heroin, fentanyl, carfentanil, opioids in general, and a lot of effort and resources go into trying to tackle that piece of the equation. And the other large piece here is mental health and disease and our approach to what seems very, you know, there is evidence all the way around that, we're wrestling with an incredible mental health epidemic to a degree. And what kind of resources do we have from that angle to tackle it?
Lisa, along those lines, WCPO.com had an article talking about how do you deal with this. Experts are saying you don't publicly shame overdose victims, because there have been a series of pictures posted of people who've OD'd, some really tragic things, even pictures where children are with them when they've overdosed. Now, you know, somebody putting that up there might say, hey, it's a warning. We're trying to discourage people from behaving this way. Think of the kid, you know, think of the child and the well-being of that child. But you've got addiction experts out there who say that these images really aren't helpful.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's exactly what the experts say. The idea is we're dealing with a health issue here, a health disorder. And would we shame somebody who has diabetes? Would we shame someone who is obese? Would we shame someone, who's wrestling with a heart disease? And the answer is no. We wrap around them the kind of medical treatment that they need and deserve. And so that's the equation that increasingly, increasingly how I see healthcare experts relay this and relay to it.
Yeah. Terry, did you want to weigh in?
That's exactly what I'm hearing too. Yeah, I think we, you know, there has been a bit of a turn, and I think a lot has been learned in the last couple of years with regards to addiction and it being a public health crisis. We have a lot of years behind us, and you know, those years are just loaded with examples, and we still see them today of people who are mistreated because of an addiction disease. But I think that...
And that's not condoning the behavior.
Never, yeah. That's not condoning it. But, and it's not, they've not completely decriminalized the things that are done in order for, that people do to feed their addiction, for example, thefts, break-ins, those sorts of things. Nobody is excusing criminal behavior. However, they know what's causing it. They're trying to get people help more and more now.
Let's talk with Mark in Middletown. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I wanted to comment on like detox and treatment. I had that problem. I've been clean for quite some time now. And, you know, I went through the methadone system. It was too late to get on the Suboxone or anything like that. But, you know, from my experience, complete abstinence is the thing. And detox and treatment instead of incarceration is another, you know, thing. I stayed out in Minnesota for 4 years. And for other states to look at the Minnesota model, Hazelden is out there. They have a, you know, it's the land of 1,000 treatment centers. And I just wondering... what's being done, more availability to detox and treatment.
Okay.
Yeah, what my understanding is there is still a real gap when it comes to the availability of facilities that offer places where one can detox. So the challenge is you have somebody who's made a decision, we're going to get help, and that isn't immediately available from a detox standpoint.
Well, Terry and Lisa, thanks so much for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're happy to be here.
Cincinnati Inquirer heroin and social issues reporter Terry DeMeo and WCPO.com issues reporter Lisa Bernard-Kuhn. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Donald Trump campaigns in Cincinnati. Bill Clinton is in Cincinnati this afternoon campaigning for his wife. So how's the presidential race shaping up in Ohio with about 3.5 weeks to go until Election Day? Joining me now, WCPO.com government and political reporter Amanda Seitz and Inquirer local politics reporter Jeremy Fugelberg. And thanks for joining me this afternoon, Jeremy and Amanda.
Thank you.
Good to see both
of
you. Donald Trump held his first campaign rally in Cincinnati. Amanda, what was the focus of his speech?
Yeah, so really there were two overwhelming themes, I think, that we saw here. The first being attack Clinton, attack her hard over and over again. So we saw that really peppered throughout the speech. The second kind of narrative that I saw coming out of that speech was him really trying to talk about policy on some level in a Donald Trump style. It's not like traditional political talk that we hear from politicians. But he hit really hard on his economic plan, talking about how he was going to punish companies that export jobs, hit really hard on Obamacare, and of course, building a wall, immigration, tightening restrictions on immigration, that sort of thing. So those were two of the things that I saw really emerging from that. He absolutely avoided any discussion surrounding the sexual assault allegations that have come out against him.
So nothing at all about that last night.
Yeah. I mean, he certainly talked about it yesterday. He was in Columbus as well. But in Cincinnati, it definitely was off the table. And he said very early, he said, you know, this is for the rest of the remainder of days left in the election, I'm going to be talking about issues. But of course, he went off issues plenty last night. So I'm not sure how well he's going to hold himself to that. But very large crowd, very excited crowd. I think I still have a headache last night from the noise. So
yeah.
It was very, very rambunctious crowd.
So what are some of your other observations from last night, Jeremy? And this is a U.S. Bank Arena, right?
Yeah, this is a U.S. Bank Arena. He said there was 21,000 people there, which I think is impossible because I believe capacity is 17 and change.
Yeah, I believe that's...
And there were definitely, I mean, the upper deck was maybe
unless they were hanging from the rafters or something.
I saw nobody hanging from the rafters, but certainly a very large crowd, a very excited crowd, a crowd very tuned up to be very angry at the media. So when the traveling press showed up, this is the members of the press that travel with Trump showed up, and I was on the other side of the risers, but they got booed and screamed at. They apparently actually got escorted out later. Minutes before Trump actually finished his speech.
Yeah, they were rounding up the National Press Corps to get them out, I would say about 5, maybe 10 minutes before his speech ended.
Right. My understanding was they actually were given a police escort out. So it was a very intense rally. I had a man behind me yelling, "Why didn't you release the video sooner?" Which I couldn't answer because I really didn't have anything to do with the video. But that intensity was definitely there.
What kind of protests at this?
So there was a number of people that gathered outside, pro-immigration groups, some pro-choice groups gathered outside. I think our reporter that was out there counted up to about 75 people that had gathered by the time Trump was due to speak. So you definitely had a range of opinions there, and there was, you know, some sarcasm too. There was one woman protester out there holding a sign that said, "Make misogyny great again." She was specifically worried. She said her biggest concern was kind of what happens on November 9th, what happens the day after. Mm-hmm. So you definitely had some current concern on the outside. But again, I mean, numbers very much dwarfed by Trump fans inside the building.
So Trump supporters, how are they reacting to all this news of inappropriate touching of women and the accusations that are coming out?
I mean, I think they definitely see this as just another thing that the media, liberal media, as they like to call it, has kind of created as an issue for Donald Trump. I don't think that they see this as a really big issue or turning point for the solid Trump supporters that have been with him all along as a big issue for them. We saw a lot of attire last night that kind of addressed the allegations in a tongue-in-cheek way. So I just don't see this as something that, you know, really gets them off board.
Yeah, the people that we talked to, you know, very much made light of it, and saw it as just a distraction that was
made
that
light
was ginned
of it.
Up.
Some were dismissive, right? Saying
absolutely
it happened
right.
A long time ago. That
yeah,
kind
we
of
talked
thing.
To one woman who said, "quote, I don't like it, and I'm not in favor of it, but it's the height of hypocrisy when the media, Hillary, the people in general feel offended by a few foul words." Again, it's just a controversy they believe ginned up by the Clinton campaign and amplified by the media.
So early voting got underway on Tuesday. What kind of activity are we seeing? Is it more than 2012, or what are the numbers looking like there?
So I heard an update from that earlier this week, and I don't have the exact numbers in front of me. My understanding was that they were doing pretty well. This is from the Clinton campaign. They had a teleconference. I believe they did say that that there was some indication it was down. It was down in for the Democrats in Columbus and in Cleveland. But that was, they didn't have a lot of very specific numbers out of Ohio.
I wouldn't be surprised, though, if some people are just kind of holding out until election day in this election. I mean, both sides are really pushing early voting hard. We've seen ads from both the Clinton and Trump campaign. But I talked to people in the primary who were... They had their candidate, Jeb Bush, for example, drop out by the time that the primary rolled around if they had early voted. So I kind of wonder how much that'll turn off people from early voting, that experience, and especially in an election where we're kind of unsure if more things will be coming out about the candidates.
Right. Such a flurry of news every day concerning the candidates that you could change your mind multiple times between now and election day.
What was interesting is early voting is typically a kind of a Democratic stronghold as far as vote support. And you do definitely see, I mean, the Trump campaign, I saw it on my own Facebook account. The Trump campaign was running Facebook ads promoting people to get out and vote early. So you see a big push from the Republicans as well to vote early.
So with the start of early voting, is that bringing on a flurry of campaign activity?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm not sure. I mean, early voting is definitely a factor here, too. But we're getting close to the end here. And Ohio is very close. And there's a lot of people in this corner of Ohio. So we are graced by many, many visits.
Yeah,
that's not going to end.
For a while. I mean, for the last couple of weeks, we haven't had much in the way of
visits.
It has
been quiet.
And Ohio, it's kind of come into question how important the state will be. But certainly this week, I mean, it looked like a premier swing state with President Obama coming to town yesterday in Columbus, Bill Clinton coming today to Cincinnati, obviously Donald Trump holding his rally last night. So it's definitely starting, I think, to look more like what we're used to.
Well, Bill Clinton is holding a campaign rally for his wife this afternoon in Washington Park and over the Rhine. Jeremy, do you have any expectations for what that's going to be?
You know, Bill Clinton is relentlessly on message. He's always folksy and good with the crowd. I don't expect to hear anything different than he said at numerous rallies over the last week, where he's, you know, defended his wife's right to run and commented generally on the video, saying, you know, how unimpressed he is by them. But I don't expect him to go off message at all on that. It's a get out the vote thing, so he's definitely going to be encouraging people to get out and vote early.
Real Clear Politics, the average of national polls that they run, that shows that Hillary Clinton is leading by 6.7% as of today. And how is the race shaping up in Ohio?
It's tight. It's tight. Of the polls that released this week, we had one that was 9 points up. That looks like an outlier because we had two polls that came out yesterday, one slightly up Trump, one slightly up Clinton. At this point, it's very close. It's very close. And there's a reason that we have candidates dropping in now and kind of cycling through Ohio pretty regularly, because it is neck and neck here.
Amanda, are you surprised that it remains so tight in Ohio?
I am. That's something that, you know, since the conventions, I've struggled to kind of figure out, not because either candidate is better than the other or because of the issues that they're talking about, simply because if you look at Ohio in the primary, and a lot of people will tell you primary voters are different from general election voters, so take this with a grain of salt as well. But if you look at the primary, we had record number of people showing up to vote in the primary, and part of that was to vote against directly Donald Trump. John Kasich took the state. Obviously, he's the governor here, so that kind of throws a wrench into things. Hillary Clinton won the primary here. So, you know, comparing Ohio to a state like Michigan, for example, where Bernie Sanders pulled out an unexpected win, where Donald Trump won, I could see where that kind of state would be polling very favorable for Donald Trump. But Ohio, it's still a little bit of a mystery to me that we're polling so favorably towards Trump.
So the analysis has been, from what I've read, is that, and just from people I've talked to, even outside of here, is, you know, there's a lot there. There are many more blue collar, white male, less educated voters in Ohio compared to some swing states, which is why you saw, you know, even a few weeks ago, you saw a real split between Ohio staying much closer to Trump than, say, a state like Pennsylvania. So I think what you're seeing is, and even in reaction to these videos, you saw some states that moved very hard toward Clinton, and you're just not seeing that in Ohio the same way. And I think it's because you have a very solid base of support for Trump that's just not moving. And it's keeping it close.
So you think, to some extent, his message about trade, labor, and jobs are resonating in Ohio?
Yes. Yeah, to a strong enough degree where it balances out where he's really getting hurt, which is female voters, and especially suburban women, better educated women who may even have voted for Republicans before, but not this time.
But he is also going to struggle with educated white men. I've talked to a lot of experts who say that he could be the first Republican to lose that demographic. So it's, you know, I'll be really interested to see, obviously, how the numbers shake out on Election Day.
Yeah, it's going to be very interesting, and I think it's going to be it's certainly shaking up some of the usual election arithmetic as far as who goes where. You're seeing people move across in ways that we haven't seen before.
Jeremy, the Inquirer had a comment from a Trump supporter who said the government in general, Republicans and Democrats, have overregulated us to death. So is that also part of the his appeal? His supporters see him as an outsider who's going to change all that and shake things up?
Yeah, that's absolutely core to his message. I mean, that's the thing. If there's anything for him that's resonated the most with his supporters, is this idea of that he's going to go into Washington and blow it up, right? Like, he's going to be the big change maker. Nothing gets done. He'll get something done. And that's a powerful message. What was interesting last night is he talked a lot about trade jobs and bringing manufacturing back to Ohio. And, you know, the question I had listening to that was, I don't know how well that's resonating in Cincinnati. We're not as manufacturing based as some parts of Ohio.
Yeah, and I think that's been a real weakness when both candidates come here. We saw Hillary Clinton reference, the auto bailout or something like that when she auto manufacturing when she came to town. Same with Trump last night. It kind of shows that I don't know that both the candidates understand really the difference between the southwest corner of Ohio versus the northeastern part of the state, which is where they're making more of their stops, right? So even Trump last night mentioned Cleveland. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know that that really resonates well with the voters here.
But there's still a strong, I mean, and we talked to some people after his speech as well, asking just that question, was how well is that resonating here? And you know, the man that was quoted in the story, Trump's message is one of the economy is not the way it should be. There are opportunities that you deserve and aren't getting. And that's a powerful message. And that's going to resonate whether you are a blue collar worker or any collar worker, if you take him at his word.
So how crucial do each of you think that Hamilton County and then the rest of Southwest Ohio are going to be for either of these candidates? How much do they need to win this corner of the state to win the entire state?
Well, first you have to ask if Hillary Clinton really needs Ohio to win the presidency. And there's a lot of people out there who believe that she doesn't. So the state becomes automatically more crucial for Donald Trump to win. I don't think that he needs Hamilton County, to be honest. I think that he needs to really, really rally his support in Butler, Warren, and Claremont. That's where a lot of Republicans are moving out to over the last couple years. I also think a crucial area for him will be Montgomery County as well. Going back to the manufacturing message that he sends, that's an area that it's traditionally a Democratic stronghold, but that message resonates very well with those type of voters. He's actually made more visits in the last couple weeks and sent more surrogates there than he has Hamilton County. So those would be the key areas for me in Southwest Ohio that I think he really needs to rack up the votes in.
Yeah, and you've seen, I mean, if you look at where Trump has visited when he has come to Southwest Ohio, it's Sharonville, it's Westchester. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are the suburban counties around Hamilton County are crucial for him. And even if he loses Hamilton County, even if Hamilton County goes Clinton, again, this isn't an election determined by which counties go where. It's a population question. And there's a tremendous mm-hmm. amount of voters who support Trump in Butler and Warren County. And they're going to show up. So those are voters he needs.
How difficult for state GOP leaders has this whole thing with Donald Trump? How difficult has it been for them?
It's sort of like playing Twister, I think. So many of the state GOP leaders were and are Kasich supporters. Mm-hmm. They're Kasich proteges. They are big Kasich fans, and their boy lost. And so now here they are with a guy that several of them were very vocally opposed to. And now he's their man. That's a tricky tightrope to walk. And you've seen support, but also very modulated and trying to draw a very narrow line between saying, you know, obviously we don't support Hillary Clinton and we're going to support our guy over Hillary Clinton. But that doesn't mean we don't have some huge problems with him.
Well, and it's been so tricky that now you see the Republicans are, fighting with one another about how their responses should be. We saw Ohio Senate President Keith Faber take the stage last night, and he's been very vocal about how he feels about people who don't support Trump. And he was campaigning regularly on the trail for John Kasich. I mean, so here you have people that are extremely at odds within their own party as to the responses to this guy.
So the Twister comparison is pretty
accurate. Oh, absolutely, yeah.
So just the other day, we were in the newsroom and pulled up a photo of, I believe it was a Romney rally from toward the end of the election in the last go-around. And he was standing up on stage, and it was all the Republican, like all the state mm-hmm. Republican leaders, and they're all wearing matching Romney Ryan jackets, looking like they're trying to be a band or something. And I mean, that's the show of unity there. Wasn't surprising then, but it's striking now.
Yes, look at last night. I mean, we had Keith Faber, we had Richard Jones from Butler County, mm-hmm. and then we had the Republican Party chair. Those were the three people that were willing to get up on that stage last night. That's telling. I mean, there were not Rob Portman isn't coming down to Cincinnati to get on stage at the Trump rally.
What do you make of Rob Portman's comment that his vote would actually be for Mike Pence?
He's trying to, keep the base happy there on some level. I mean, you know, because Mike Pence kind of is that type of traditional Republican that Republicans have usually rooted for. So, again, walking that fine line of, hey, I still really strongly support Republican values, but I don't support this guy.
But again, just it wouldn't make any difference because Pence actually isn't a write-in candidate. So he could put Pence on the ballot and it wouldn't count. So that's not going to work. But as far as the GOP supporters, you know, the lieutenant governor, who is a Trump supporter, was actually in town yesterday and stopped by the Inquirer office a couple of hours before the Trump rally. And so I thought, oh, maybe she's here for the Trump rally. And I checked and no, she wasn't actually even going to be there.
Yeah, they do not want photographic evidence that they're on stage with this guy. And if he loses, you know, people can run campaign ads against them for years to come.
Now, in the Senate race between Rob Portman and Ted Strickland, Portman has a solid lead in the polling, but with accusations against Donald Trump, the potential for more accusations to come out, how much concern do you think that this is causing for Portman?
He's got a double-digit lead. If you look at the polls that have been coming out in Ohio, just even for Ohio in general, this hasn't made a huge difference. I mean, we're looking at a couple percentage points one way or the other. So, you know, the idea that it's going to erase a double-digit lead for Portman is very wishful thinking.
Certainly, I'd be interested to see. Yeah, he has this big lead still. The polls still show him hanging on. But I wonder if he'll lose some support from some of the, like, Mahoning Valley Trump supporters. And I kind of wonder if that was part of his huge lead that he's had all along. So him unendorsing Trump could really anger some of those.
Alienates that particular group.
Yes. And the group that many have argued, you know, are former Democrats on some level that will vote for Trump. And that's part of why Strickland struggled. And that's part of why Portman's done so well.
On the other side of the equation, though, you think that Ted Strickland's watching this and saying, this is good news for me. This might actually help me.
It's immensely. Probably one sure. of the few joys he's getting out of this campaign. I mean, to be.
Yeah. I mean, he had Obama show up for him last night, said a lot of nice things. But he needs more than that. And you've seen the Democrats have pulled out advertising support in Ohio for him, trying to put it into other more viable races. So, you know, this is still considered, at this point, pretty safe for Portman, mm-hmm. Even if he does lose some support out of this.
Now, we have the next and last presidential debate coming up. What, next week, Amanda?
Mm-hmm. Next Wednesday.
Next Wednesday. So what do you expect to see from that?
I don't know if I'll make any predictions. I am interested to see, though, if it is, you know, as negative, as in the mud as we got last time around. It'll be interesting to see if the Trump campaign really felt like they benefited from doing things like holding a press conference with women who are accusing the Clintons of harassment and abuse. I think that's what I'm watching for. You know, we did get some interesting policy questions throughout the debate. Of course, the candidates didn't really directly answer any of those, but I'd be interested to see, you know, we have Chris Wallace moderating. I don't know that he said that he doesn't view like fact-checking as part of his role.
Right.
In this debate.
Said he won't interrupt them. He'd rather see them debate each other and argue with each other, I think is how he put it.
Right. So, yeah. I don't see this being a very substantive debate this time around. And we haven't gotten a lot of substance in any of the debates. So
I think what's so frustrating here, and he's frustrating just in terms of being a reporter watching this, is it's very hard to know. I mean, it's a half week out, and it's honestly anybody's guess what happens between now and then, because that's the kind of campaign this has been. So, you know, the allegations about videos about Trump's video.
The inappropriate touching allegations,
correct.
And
mm-hmm.
things like
and then
that.
Clinton's, and, yeah. Clinton's WikiLeaks email.
That's continuing, isn't it?
That's
I mean, he's
been,
still releasing
there's
more.
Been a drip, drip, drip of that. So those have been coming up. But again, I mean, between now and Wednesday, that's a lot of time.
Mm-hmm.
The Trump camp has stuck very steadily to the hammering on Bill Clinton's, on accusing Bill Clinton and bringing out accusers of Bill Clinton. And that's something that they've stuck to, and they don't show any signs of backing away from that. So I don't know if they continue that kind of thing in the next debate or whether they switch strategies or decide to focus on something else entirely or some other bombshell drops.
Who knows is what you're saying.
Yeah, it's Friday. It's Friday, and honestly, I could not tell you what's going to be the big thing to talk about by Wednesday.
Amanda, let's shift to a local race, the Hamilton County Commission race. And the candidates have actually started releasing ads, haven't they?
Yes, yeah. And it kind of shows just how important this race is, right? I mean, it's kind of a big deal. It's going to be...
And this is Denise Driehaus and Dennis Dieters.
Okay. Yes, yes. Denise being the state representative, Democrat, Dennis being the current Hamilton County Commissioner appointed to the position by the Republicans.
So you're saying it's a very important race. We have the ads coming out. And what have you observed about the ads?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. Both ads have been very positive, upbeat. Denise's ad released earlier this week showed her at a brewery, I believe it was Listerman Brewery, pouring up some beer, talking about, you know, businesses and the county helping out businesses and, you know, rah-rah. Dennis's ad was released today, a little bit more of a somber tone because it featured Cincinnati Police Union Chief Dan Hills talking about how Dennis was very supportive of his family during the loss of his daughter. So very, positive, talking about the candidates. I've even heard some people within both parties.
So they're not attacking each other, in other words,
correct.
Right?
Okay. And I've actually heard people within both parties suggest that they kind of need to a little bit more, that they'd like to see the candidates differentiate themselves a little more. So, you know, I'll be interested to see. It seems like at this point it's kind of become a game of who blinks first, right? No one wants to be the one to throw the first punch here. And it'll be interesting to see if anyone breaks down and does it by Election Day.
But also kind of refreshing, considering everything else going on
yes.
in this campaign, to see two candidates taking the high road and talking about themselves in a positive way. That's refreshing.
Well, it's kind of interesting, too, Jeremy, because the Inquirer and endorsing a commission candidate, they endorsed Denise Driehaus in this particular race, but they also noted in their comments that it was pretty tough because they liked You guys like both candidates,
right,
apparently.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, I have to restate. Like, I'm a reporter. I have nothing to do with the endorsement process that the editorial. I didn't even know about it before their choice, before they came out with it. But that was definitely, you know, it wasn't a clear, we totally go one way or the other. It was definitely a mixed bag, but her experience gave her the edge.
They've both done good things in government. I mean, I think that's what makes this really hard. Dennis has really touted his time as Coleraine Township trustee, working on heroin initiatives. Denise has, you know, worked really in a bipartisan manner over at the State House. So they both have a, you know, fairly good record to tout. They don't have, you know, any dirt that we know of, at least in their history. Mm-hmm. They're both kind of these clean, good politicians. And I think that's what kind of makes it a difficult race.
It's nice having two good choices.
Yeah, yes, yeah.
It's as you were saying, Jeremy, it's refreshing.
If only we could have that at the presidential level,
yeah.
Right?
My guess is their unfavorables, if those got poll tested, would not be anywhere close to, you know, what we see with Trump and Clinton.
Yeah, no.
Well, Jeremy and Amanda, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
WCPO.com government and political reporter Amanda Seitz and Inquirer local politics reporter Jeremy Fugelberg. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition. Archives of our programs are available at WVXU.org. The producer for today's show was Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer was Belinda Kai. Dave Shermer was the technical director. William White composed the Cincinnati Edition theme music. I'm Mark Haney. Cincinnati Observatory Assistant Director and co-host of the popular public television series Stargazers, Dean Regas, has published his first book, Facts from Space. On the next Cincinnati edition, we'll talk with Dean Regas about the stars. We'll also hear about the latest Hollywood stars in town and Cincinnati's growing film industry. And in Focus on Technology, the Cincinnati Cyclones are using high-tech equipment to keep them safe this season. That Cincinnati edition, Monday afternoon at 1 on 91.7 WVXU.